Love and marriage, love and marriage, go together like a horse and carriage. Dad was told by mother, you can't have one, you can't have none, you can't have one without the other.
So we tell each other that love and marriage go hand in hand, but do they really have an awful lot to do with each other? We'll explore tonight what it takes to make a marriage on this The Sharon Hour Just Starting with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. I've approached this topic before from a slightly different angle, even with words of wisdom from the same writer-philosopher Alain de Botton, from whom you're going to hear now. He wrote an article for the New York Times titled, Why You Will Marry the Wrong Person. He followed it up with the talk I'm going to excerpt from now. And maybe a lot of us get scared that we're either about to marry the wrong person or perhaps already have.
How many of you do feel, on balance, that you have married the wrong person? But I'm here to give counsel and to give consolation for this situation. You know, there's a lot of anger around our love lives, privately held. But a lot of us go around feeling quite enraged, angry, privately, about the way that our love lives have gone. My task today is to turn that anger into sadness. If we manage to turn rage into grief, we will have made psychological progress. And this is the task today. What lies behind rage very often is an unusual quality, because we tend to think that very angry people are sort of dark and pessimistic characters. Absolutely not. Scratch the surface of any regularly angry person and you will find a wild optimist. It is, in fact, hope that drives rage. Think of the person who screams every time they can't find their house keys or every time they get stuck in traffic. These unfortunate characters are evincing a curious but reckless faith in a world in which keys never go astray, the roads are mysteriously traffic-free. It is hope that is turbocharging their rage. So if we're to get a little bit less sad and a little less angry about our love lives, we will have to diminish some of our hopes. It's very hard to diminish hope around love because there are vast industries designed to inflate our expectations of love. There was a wonderful quote from the German philosopher Theodor Adorno, who in the 1960s said that the most dangerous man in America was Walt Disney. And the reason for his attack on Walt was because he believed that Walt was the prime agent of hope, and therefore of rage, and therefore of bitterness. And he thought that it was the task of philosophy to let us down gently, which is what I'm going to be doing today. So, why you will marry the wrong person? There are a number of reasons why this is going to happen to you, or has maybe already, in the privacy of your heart, happened to you. I should say that it's not that bad. And the reason is that all of us will not manage to find the right person, but we will probably all of us manage to find a good enough person. So, and that's success, as you will come to see. One of the reasons why we're not going to be able to pull this one off as successfully as we might have hoped at the outset of our teenagehood, when we were contemplating love, is that we are very strange. I'm very strange, and you're very strange. You don't let on, and you know we're not going to do anything very dangerous, but we are basically psychologically quite strange. We don't normally know very much about this strangeness. It takes us a long, long time before we're really on top of the way in which we are hard to live with. Does anyone think that they're quite easy to live with, on balance? Okay. I know that you're not easy to live with. And the reason is that you're a Homo sapiens, and therefore you are not easy to live with. No one is. But there's a wall of silence that surrounds us from a deeper acquaintance with what is actually so difficult about us. Our friends don't want to tell us. Why would they bother? They just want a pleasant evening out. Our friends know more about us and more about our flaws, probably after a 10-minute acquaintance. A stranger will know more about your flaws than you might learn over 40 years of life on the planet. Our capacity to intuit what is wrong with us is very weak. Our parents don't tell us very much. Why would they? They love us too much. They know. They can see, of course. I mean, they followed us from the crib. They know what's wrong with us. They're not going to tell us because they just want to be sweet. And our ex-lovers, a vital source of knowledge, they know. Absolutely, they know. But do you remember that speech that they gave? It was moving at the time when they said that they wanted a little more space and were attracted to travel and were interested in the culture of Southeast Asia. Nonsense. they thought lots of things were wrong with you, but they weren't going to be bothered to tell you. They were just off out of there. Why would they bother? So this knowledge that is out there is not in you. It's out there, but it's not in you. And so therefore we progress through the world with a very low sense of what is actually wrong with us. Not least, all of us are addicts. Almost all of us are addicts. Not injecting heroin as such, but addicts in the sense, we need to redefine what addiction is. I like to define addiction not in terms of the substance you're taking. In other words, you know, I'm a heroin addict, I'm a cocaine addict. No. Addiction is basically any pattern of behavior whereby you cannot stand to be with yourself and certain of the more uncomfortable thoughts and, more importantly, emotions that come from being on your own. And so, therefore, you can be addicted to almost anything so long as it keeps you away from yourself, so long as it keeps you away from tricky self-knowledge. And most of us are addicts. And thanks to all sorts of technologies and distractions, etc., we can have a good life where we will almost certainly be guaranteed not to spend any time with ourselves. And this is a disaster for your capacity to have a relationship with another person. Because until you know yourself, you can't properly relate to another person.
Marry me, John, marry me, John, I'll be so good to you. You won't realize I'm gone. Marry me, John, marry me, John, I'll be so sweet to you. You won't realize I'm gone. You won't realize I'm gone. Many people wanna make money, make love, make friends, make peace with death. But most mainly wanna win the game they came to win. They want to come out ahead. But you, you're a rock with a heart like a socket I can plug into at will. When I come around next, I hope your open sign is blinking still. So marry me, John, marry me, John, I'll be so good to you. You won't realize I'm gone. Marry me, John, marry me, John, I'll be so good to you. You won't realize I've gone. As for me, I would have to agree, I'm as fickle as a paper doll. Being kicked by the wind down again, I'll be in someone else's arms. Oh, John, come on, we'll do what married people do. Oh, John. Without
marriage isn't always what we thought it was going to be. We have to navigate it skillfully for it to work. And we're getting some pointers here on just how to do that on this, the Sharon Hour Tonight, with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX93.5. The pointers are currently coming from a talk given by philosopher Alain de Botton, who has quite a bit to impart on this subject of love and marriage.
One of the reasons why love is so tricky for us is that it requires us to do something we really don't want to do, which is to approach another human being and say, I need you. I wouldn't really survive without you. I am vulnerable before you. And there's a very strong impulse in all of us to be strong and to be well defended and not to reveal our vulnerability to another person. Psychologists talk of two patterns of response that tend to crop up in people whenever there's a danger of needing to be extremely vulnerable, dangerously vulnerable, and exposed to another person. The first response is to get what psychologists call anxiously attached. This is attachment theory, some of you may know. So when you are anxiously attached to somebody, rather than saying, I need you, I depend on you, you start to get very procedural. You say, you're 10 minutes late, or I think the bin bags need to be taken out, or you start to get strict when actually what you want to do is to ask a very poignant question, do you still care about me? But we don't dare to ask that question. So instead, we get nasty, we get stiff, we get procedural. The other pattern of behavior, which psychologists have identified, and it tends to apply to A types, very outgoing types, strivers, you become, in relationships, what is known as avoidant, which means that when you need someone, it's precisely at that moment that you pretend you don't. When you feel most vulnerable, you say, I'm quite busy at the moment. No, I'm fine, thanks. I'm well busy today. In other words, you don't reveal the need for another person, which sets them off into a chain of wondering whether you are to be trusted. And there's then a cycle of low trust. So we get into these patterns of not daring to do the thing that we really need to do, which is to say, even though I'm a grown person, maybe I've got a beard, maybe I've been alive for a long time, I'm 6'2", etc. I'm actually a small child inside, and I need you like a small child would need its parent. This is so humbling that most of us refuse to make that step and therefore refuse the challenge of love. In short, we don't know very much how to love. And it sounds very odd, because imagine if somebody said to you, look, all of us probably in this room would probably need to go to a school of love. We think, what, a school of love? Love is just an instinct. No, it's not. It's a skill, and it's a skill that needs to be learned, and it's a skill that our society refuses to consider as a skill. We are meant to always just follow our feelings. If you keep following your feelings, you will almost certainly make a big mistake in your life. First of all, there's a distinction between loving and being loved. We all start off in life by knowing a lot about being loved. Being loved is the fun bit. That's when somebody brings you something on a tray and asks you how your day at school went, etc. And we grow up thinking that that is what's going to happen in an adult relationship. We can be forgiven for that. It's an understandable mistake, but it's a very tragic mistake, and it leads us not to pay attention to the other side of the equation, which is to love. And what does it really mean to love? To love, ultimately, is to have the willingness to interpret someone's, on the surface, not very appealing behavior in order to find more benevolent reasons why it may be unfolding. In other words, to love someone is to apply charity and generosity of interpretation. Most of us are in dire need of love, because actually we need to have some slack cut for us, because our behavior is often so tricky that if we don't do this, we wouldn't get through any kind of relationship. But we're not used to thinking that that is the core of what love is. Core of what love is the willingness to interpret another's behavior. What we tend to be very bad at is recognizing that anyone that we can love is going to be a perplexing mixture of the good and the bad. There's a wonderful psychoanalyst called Melanie Klein, who was active in the 50s and 60s, originally from Vienna, active in North London, studying how children learned about relationships from the parental situation. And she came up with a very fascinating analysis. She argued that when children are small, very small, they don't really realize that a parent is one character. They actually do what she calls split a parent into a good parent and a bad parent. And so this is when a baby is, you know, really at infant stage. So what you do is you split into the good mother and the bad mother. And it takes a long, long time. Melanie Klein thought it might be until you're four, until you actually realize that the good and the bad mother are one person, and you become ambivalent. In other words, you become able to hate someone and really go off them, and at the same time also love them, and you're able not to run away from that situation. You're able to say, I love someone and hate them, and that's okay. And Melanie Klein thought this is an immense psychological achievement, when we can no longer merely divide people into absolutely brilliant, perfect, what marvelous, and hateful, let me down, disappointed me. Everyone who we love is going to disappoint us. We start off with idealization and we end up often with denigration. The person goes from being absolutely marvelous to being absolutely terrible. Maturity is the ability to see that there are no heroes or sinners really among human beings, that all of us have this wonderfully perplexing mixture of the good and the bad. And adulthood, true psychological maturity, and you may need to be 65 before it hits you, I'm not there yet, is the capacity to realize that anyone that you love is going to be this mixture of the good and the bad. So love is not just admiration for strength, it is also tolerance for weakness and recognition of ambivalence.
Hush now, don't explain. Just say you'll
expectations, don't we, when it comes to love and relationships and marriage. Some have lower expectations, some have maybe unrealistically high ones. You're listening to The Sharer now with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX 93.5. My topic tonight is how to do marriage. We love the idea of marriage, but we don't always know how to do it. Philosopher Alain de Botton has things to say about that.
The reason why we're going to probably make some real mistakes when we choose our love partners, some of you have made some stunning mistakes. Now, why is this? The reason is that we've been told that the way to find a good partner is to follow your instinct. Follow your heart. That's the mantra. And so we're all the time reminded that if we stop reasoning, analyzing, that sort of view, people go, yeah, you can think too much. A few people, okay, you can't think too much. You can only ever think badly. But there's no such thing as thinking too much about emotions. But the problem is we live in a romantic culture that privileges impulse. Now, when it comes to love, something tricky occurs because you don't have to be a paid-up believer in psychotherapy or psychoanalysis to realize that the way we love as adults sits on top of our early childhood experiences. And in early childhood, the way that we learned about love was not just via experiences of tenderness and kindness and generosity. The love that we will have tasted as children will also be bound up with experiences of being let down, being humiliated, maybe being with a parent who treated us very harshly, who scolded us, who made us feel small in some way. In other words, quite a lot about our early experiences of love are bound up with various kinds of suffering. Now, something quite bad happens when we start to go out into the adult world and start to choose love partners. We think we're out to find partners who will make us happy, but we're not. We're out to find partners who will feel familiar. And that may be a very different thing, because familiarity may be bound up with particular kinds of torture. And this explains why sometimes people will say to us, look, there's a wonderful person, you should go and date them. They're good looking, they're charming, they're all sorts of things. And we go out with them and we date them. And we do recognize that they're really wonderful and amazing. But we have to confess to our friends that actually we found this person, often we struggle with the vocabulary. We say, maybe not that exciting, or maybe not sexy, or a bit boring. But really what we mean is that we've detected in this really quite accomplished person someone who will not be able to make us suffer in the way that we need to suffer in order to feel that love is real. And that's why we reject them. So we are not merely on a quest to be happy. We are on a quest to suffer in ways that feel familiar. And this radically undermines our capacity to find a good partner.
Myself, the happy host.
You are tuned to The Share Now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX93.5. My topic tonight is how to do marriage. And philosopher Alain de Botton has a lot to impart to us on that subject.
Here's another reason why we're going to come unstuck in the field of love. We tend to believe that the more a lover is right for us, the less we're going to have to explain about who we are, how we feel, what upsets us, what we want. We believe, rather as a young child believes of its parent, that a true lover will guess what is in our minds. One of the great errors that human beings make is permanently to feel that other people know what's in their minds without us having said what's in our minds. It's very cumbersome to use words. It's such a bore. And when it comes to love, we have this deep desire that we'll simply be understood wordlessly. It's touching, it's a beautiful romantic idea, but it also leads to a catastrophic outbreak of sulking. Sulking is an interesting phenomenon. We don't just sulk with anyone. We sulk with people who we feel should understand us, and yet for some reason have decided not to. And that's why we tend to reserve our sulks for people who we love and who we think love us. They tell us something, you know, unwittingly will trigger a negative reaction in us, and we'll sulk. And they'll say, "What's wrong with you, darling?" And we'll say, "Nothing." And they'll say, "But come on, you're upset." And we'll go, "No, I'm not. I'm absolutely fine." And it's not true. And we'll go upstairs and we'll shut the door and we won't tell them what's wrong with us. And then they'll knock at the door and they'll say, "Please, just tell me." And we'll say no, because we want them to read our souls, because we expect that a true lover can understand what we feel and who we are without us speaking. This is a catastrophe for our capacity to form lasting relationships. If you do not explain, you can never be understood. The root to a good marriage and to good love is the ability to become a good teacher. Now, teaching sounds like a narrow profession. Those guys in tweed jackets and fusty with a chalkboard, etc. I'm not talking about that kind of teaching. All of us, whatever our job aspirations, whatever it is we do, have to become teachers. Now, teaching is merely the word that we give to the skill of getting an idea from one head into another in a way that is likely to be accepted. And most of us are appalling teachers. Most of us teach when we're tired, when we're frightened. What are we frightened of? We're frightened we've married an idiot. And because we're so frightened, we start screaming at them. "You've got to understand." And the thing is that unfortunately, by the time you've started to humiliate the person you want to understand something, lesson over. You will never get anyone to understand what you want them to understand so long as you make them feel small. In order to teach well, you need to be relaxed. You need to accept that maybe your partner won't understand. And also, you need a culture within a couple that two people are going to need to teach each other and therefore also learn from one another. And this brings me to the next reason why you're going to have a very unhappy relationship, probably. And that is because you probably believe that when somebody tries to tell you something about yourself that's a little ticklish and a little uncomfortable, they are attacking you. They're not. They're trying to make you into a better person. And we don't tend to believe that this has a role in love. We tend to believe that true love means accepting the whole of us. It doesn't. No one should accept the whole of us. We're appalling. Really, you want the whole of you accepted? No, that's not love. The full display of our characters, the full articulation of who we are, should not be something that we do in front of anyone that we care about. So what we need to do is to accept that the other person is going to want to educate us and that it isn't a criticism. Criticism is merely the wrong word that we apply to a much nobler idea, which is to try and make us into better versions of ourselves. But we tend to reject this idea very strongly.
You're tuned to The Share Now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's one and only KX93.5, talking tonight about how to do marriage. Philosopher Alain de Botton tends to think we go into it hoping for the best, with our eyes closed a lot of the time to who and what makes the ideal partner. Yet he still has hopes for us all and the institution, particularly when it comes to parenting and our fears that, let alone not having made the ideal marriage, we might not have made the ideal parents.
Look, I mentioned the word good enough. It's a phrase taken from a wonderful English psychoanalyst called Donald Winnicott. He had a lot of parents who would come to him and say things like, "I'm so worried, I'm not a good parent, my child has this problem or that problem, etc." And he came up with a wonderful phrase. He said, "You are most likely to be a good enough parent." It's a relief from our otherwise punishing perfectionism. The good thing is that none of us are perfect, and therefore we don't need perfection. And the demand for perfection will lead you to only one thing: loneliness. You cannot have perfection and company. To be in company with another person is to be negotiating imperfection every day. We are all incompatible, but it is the work of love to make us graciously accommodate each other and ourselves to each other's incompatibilities. And therefore, compatibility is an achievement of love. It isn't what you need from the outset. Of course, you're not going to be totally compatible. That's not the point. It is through love that you gradually accept the need to be compatible. We probably can't change our types, right? So many of us have got types who are going to cause us real problems. They may be too distant. They may be arrogant. They're going to torture us in some way. Now, friends casually say to us, chuck them, get out the relationship, etc., right? No, I'm giving you realistic advice. You're not going to manage to change your type. Let's get that for granted. What you can do, and this is a big achievement, is to change how you characteristically respond to your tricky type. Most of us have formed the way that we respond to tricky types in early childhood. So we had a distant parent, we've now chosen a distant lover. When we were very young, we responded to that distant parent by attention-seeking. We rattled and banged, and now we're adults, we rattle and bang in our own way, and we think that's going to help. It doesn't. It creates a cycle that's going to be a vicious cycle. It's not going to get us anywhere. It is open to us at any time to have a more mature response to the challenges that the types of people we're attracted to are going to pose for us. And that is an immense step forward, an immense achievement. The other thing we should do is recognize the nobility of compromise. One of the most shameful things to ever have to admit is to say, this is my partner, I've compromised. In choosing them, I've compromised. Oh, why have you compromised? Well, I'm not that attractive myself. I've got lots of problems. I'm a bit nutty. Frankly, I couldn't pull anyone better, but they're very nice. They're okay. Now, you would think, loser. It's not true. Compromise is noble. We compromise in every area of life. There's no reason why we shouldn't compromise in our love life. Maybe we're sticking around for the children. Good. People say, oh, they're only sticking around for the children. That's a wonderful reason to stick around. Why else are you going to stick around? So let's look a bit more benevolently at the art of compromise. It's a massive achievement in love. I'm going to end with a quote from one of my favorite philosophers, Danish 19th century, very gloomy philosopher, Kierkegaard. And Kierkegaard, in his book, Either Or, had a wonderful outburst where he basically said, of course, you're going to marry the wrong person and make the wrong decisions in a whole row of areas. And the reason you're going to do this is that you're human. Therefore, do not berate yourself for doing what humans do. This is what he says. Marry and you will regret it. Don't marry, you will also regret it. Marry or don't marry, you will regret it either way. Laugh at the world's foolishness, you'll regret it. Weep over it, you'll regret that too. Laugh at the world's foolishness or weep over it, you will regret both. Hang yourself, you will regret it. Don't hang yourself, you will regret that too. Hang yourself or don't hang yourself, you'll regret it either way. Whether you hang yourself or don't hang yourself, you will regret both. This, gentleman, is the essence of all philosophy.
And possibly all relationships too. You're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935, talking tonight about how to do marriage. The problem often exists that we had a vision of love and the partner that we would spend the rest of our life with, and the one we're about to choose or the one we've already chosen might be for reasons we hadn't originally considered and might not ultimately completely match up. Treated me kind, sweet destiny, carried me through desperation. The one that was waiting for me. It took so long. Still I believed somehow the one that I needed would find me eventually. I had a vision of love, and it was all that you've given to me. All that you've given to me.
you've given me.
You are tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. My topic tonight is how to do marriage. And in this next segment, a man called Neil is bemoaning his particular marital problem in an audience with motivational speaker Tony Robbins.
I'm having a lot of conflict about what I should do and what I should believe, and I'm scared to death to go home. I don't want to be in the situation to have to go home and say to my daughter, Daddy's not going to be living here anymore. Me and my wife had a big fight, which we still haven't resolved. I spoke to my daughters when my daughter's 5.5 years old, and then said, can I speak to Mummy? I said, oh, I miss you. She goes, oh. I said, you miss me? I've been really busy. I want to be with my wife. I love my wife. But we don't have that many things in common. We've got a lot of different things that we value and that we're interested in. Doing, you know, really early mornings to late nights. I've got outside interests as well, which she doesn't like. I play in a band.
But you could be there because you could give up the band.
Yeah.
And she'd like you to do that.
Yeah.
What instrument do you play?
Guitar.
Tell me what it feels like when you play the guitar.
It's astonishing. It's like being a god.
And when you go home with your wife, how significant do you feel?
Tony Robbins turns to the audience and says, so what do you think the chances are of him giving up the band? The guy, Neil, jumps in here.
No. No way. No way.
He'll give her up before he'll give up the band.
We had a fight about that about a year ago. It was a case of you will do something about this or else. And we came to a compromise that I would only play 3 times a month, something like that.
I see. She's saying, here's something that makes him feel like a god, and the maximum you can be godlike is 3 times a month. And here's what I want from you. By the way, I love you. But she wouldn't see it that way, I'm sure, because what she's saying is you're not here with your family, you're not here with me, you're not here with your kids, you're not here with whatever. Do you love your wife?
Yes.
Why'd you pause?
I'm questioning it.
Yeah. The reason he's questioning it is because he's not fulfilled there. So if I'm not fulfilled, how could I love her? And if she doesn't want me to be completely fulfilled, how can I love her? And even if I love her, I don't want to believe I love her because then I'm trapped. How far off am I?
Bang on.
Well, if I asked your wife, score Neil for me, how significant does he make you feel? I want to switch hats. You're in her body right now. How significant does he make you feel, 0 to 10? You know, when he leaves, never comes home, makes the band more important than you are. He knows how you hate that rock music and he wants to go play it anyway.
Maybe a 3.
3. Does he love you?
Yes.
How loved do you feel, though, these days, 0 to 10 by him?
3.
And how certain are you that he's going to stay and love you?
8 or 9.
8 or 9. How certain do you feel, though, in moments about that?
I think an 8.
You're thinking as yourself right now. This is where you're deluded. How much variety does he bring home to you? Surprise, desires, playfulness you don't expect to serve you, to light you up. 0 to 10.
5. 5.
How much are you guys growing together?
None.
0?
0.
How much do you feel like he's trying to contribute to you?
Probably 0.
So here's a man who wants to contribute nothing to you. On a 0 to 10, thinks you're a 3 in importance. On a 0 to 10, thinks you're a 3 of love. Give you a 5 of variety, but he's sticking around at an 8. What would you want to do, Neil, if you were her?
Change him or get rid of him.
Well, you're thinking like a man with a get rid of him part. He is the father of your daughter. Are you really going to just get rid of him?
No idea.
Yes, you do. Is he the source of your security financially?
Yes.
Are you going to get rid of him? He's
no.
The father of your daughter, and he's the source of your survival. Are you going to get rid of him?
No.
No. What are you going to do when you feel insignificant and unloved and uncontributed to and not growing with? What are you going to do?
Make him change.
Make him change. You're right. How are you going to do that? What tools do you have in your arsenal?
Make him stay at home more often.
How are you going to make him stay at home?
Give him an ultimatum.
Give him an ultimatum. What's the ultimatum say?
It says it's you spend more time at home and you don't go off playing with the band.
Or?
Or I leave.
And take your daughter.
With you. Or, no, she'll probably say, or you leave.
And I'll keep your daughter.
Yeah.
What's her nature? Not when you're frustrated with her. When she feels herself, not when she's stressed, what's her nature?
She's very creative in her own way. You know, she's into art. She paints. She doesn't do it often enough because she always says she's not good enough, even though the stuff you do is fantastic. Let's put it up on the wall. You should sell this to a gallery. You should exhibit. Oh, I'm not good enough. I'm not good enough.
But that's the female form. Women do that with each other. But that's one downsmanship. She's begging for your attention.
Yeah, which I give.
I don't know, but she wants so much more. So do you like that nature, that artistic nature? Does that appeal to you?
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
In fact, isn't that part of your nature?
If she follows it, but she represses it on herself.
No, she's begging for you to be her man and show her the artist inside. Goals in life. Her goals are to?
No idea. I've no idea what her goals are.
So at this point, Tony Robbins suggests that he can't leave this man, Neil, he's counseling, until he stops focusing so much on himself and knows what his wife's goals are, what she wants. You're tuned to The Sharer now with me, Sharon James, on Gunas KX935. My topic tonight is how to do marriage. And of course, Tony Robbins has made himself a guru in these and other personal relationship matters. Here's the point he's trying to make in this particular instance. Give it your all for 90 days.
Until you've gone and giving everything you have as a man to fill up those 6 needs with her at 10s, you can't walk away. Because you haven't done what's necessary, and you know it. That's why you're on the fence. Because if you'd really done everything, you would have left, because you're a smart man and you're a strong man. What does it take for her to feel loved? What is she really after in this life? Fill her up so much that she wants to give to you now. And she says, honey, go to the band. Go do it twice a week. But you won't know until you give completely and totally. No holds barred. That woman needs to be lit up. And even if she wasn't the right woman for you, the next 90 days should be the greatest 90 days of her life, where never has a man given her more attention and focus and caring and love. And you tell her after those 90 days, this is what I need, honey. Can we make this work?
Not a bad suggestion. So can he give it his all for 90 days? Well, he does. It saves the marriage. His wife is very happy. He stays in the band. All is well. I guess really the key is not necessarily what they ended up putting into it, but the fact that they actually established the problem in the first place and laid it out in a way that seemed reasonable for both of them. So communication comes first, and then comes compromise, something we all know deep down is a prerequisite for basically any relationship, but certainly one where you live together and share a household. How to do marriage is the topic of my Sharer Now tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX935. And since we're introducing here relationship gurus, here next is Belgian relationship expert Esther Perel. She's talking about fights in a marriage, and she thinks it's okay to fight. You just have to learn how to navigate those fights. The fighting itself is normal, if not mandatory.
It's a must. But the question is not so much the fighting. The question is really the repair. I think relationships follow a cycle of harmony, disharmony, and repair. When people fight about the same stuff, What they're fighting about is not the towel or the bathroom or who takes care of what or who takes the children every day or who is always late. What they're fighting about are actually three key groups of themes that are underneath those plot lines, which is power and control, closeness and care, and respect and recognition. Look, some people come with a history where they learned. We learn to fight. We learn to argue. We learn to defend ourselves. We learn certain ways for asking for what we want. Or we learn certain way never to ask for what we want, but to criticize the other for doing it when you can't do it yourself. And we come with those schoolings of our relationships that usually we learned in our own homes by watching our parents with each other and with us. Some people are maximizers. They explode. Some people are minimizers. They implode. They keep it in. They wait. They wait. They wait. And then they explode. And over something that has nothing to do with the thing they're actually annoyed about. But this is the right moment. The more one person goes up, the more the very person that goes up is actually making the other person go numb. And the more the person goes shuts down, the more it actually activates this one to go higher and higher. Each person is actually contributing to the extreme version that the other person becomes.
What about bickering?
I would say bickering is chronic low-intensity warfare in which I am picking and I'm critical all the time. And instead of saying, I would like a cup of water, I say, why did you take a cup for yourself? And I am not telling you what I wish, because behind every criticism is a wish. I'm just going at it and making you feel low. I also, when I talk about the cup, I remind you of the shoes and of the friend you didn't call back and of what your mother told me 17 years ago. And I do what is called kitchen sinking, meaning I pile up all the dirty dishes at the same time so that at the end we have no idea what we're actually fighting about. It began with the cup of water, and it ended up with the day that you broke up with me when we were going on our first date. So you do kitchen sinking, you do chronic picking, the bickering. You also do two things. One is called confirmation bias, which is that now that I've decided that you really are a slob and you don't care about whatever I ask you, I look for it. I look for it. It's like a radar that is looking to confirm the bias that I have. If I believe you don't care, if I believe this doesn't matter, I scan it. And I disregard evidence that proves the opposite. The one time, if you say, but I did it yesterday, I said, that's just yesterday. That's one time. That doesn't count because look, ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. And, you know, the whole scoreboard arrives. And the next thing I do is what we call fundamental attribution error, which is that if I am late, it's because there was traffic. If you are late, it's because you are a total disorganized slob. Mine is circumstance, yours is characterological. If I'm in a bad mood, it's because I had a bad day. If you're in a bad mood, it's because you're a cranky human being.
You're tuned to The Sharon Hour on Laguna's KX935. I'm Sharon James. My topic tonight is how to do marriage. Well, I don't know, but I've been presenting some relationship experts who think they have some answers, and we're currently listening to one such person, Esther Perel. She's on a Belgian chat show talking to men. She's the only woman there. And the host of the chat show now turns to one of those men sitting on the panel and asks him how he reacts in a marital fight. What would his wife say?
She will say, I'm stubborn and wrong.
Stubborn and wrong.
I'm wrong. Yeah. She's right, I'm wrong.
Yeah, but you don't give up, at least.
I mean, very much taken by what we hear here. I mean, of course, the bigger the love, the more important the quarrel. I mean, a person you're just passing in the street cannot harm you in any real way. A colleague which is distant can maybe harm you a little bit, but not much. A very close colleague or a close friend can harm you a lot. And your partner, of course, is the person who can harm you the most. Mm-hmm. So the greater the love, the more important.
She knows the buttons.
She knows every single weakness I've ever displayed in my life, for sure.
I don't fight so much, but after this, I'm going to go home and fight.
It's kind of the question of, can people fight better, right? Is there a way that you can minimize some of the escalation? Basically, a bad fight is a negative escalation. And a negative escalation follows a very classic pattern. Attack, blame, defend. How do you turn that around so that people can actually hear each other? Because behind anger, there is often hurt. Behind criticism, there is something you want. There's an unmet longing, a wish, a need, etc. And this thing about not being right is, can you imagine that there is this person that is so close to you that actually has a completely different experience of what just happened? And that's very challenging in a relationship, because if I feel this way, you must have done this. Otherwise, why am I feeling it? It cannot be that I feel so neglected and that you think you were being really warm, for example, right? And so the next thing that is, of course, the most difficult thing to do is to talk about what you feel versus talk about what the other person did or did not do. You know, it's a way of saying, I can hear you and still disagree with you. Versus if I hear you, then it means that I agree with you. And when you are in conflict situations, we have the ability to listen to 10 seconds. And 10 seconds is 3 sentences before in our head we've stopped listening and we are preparing the rebuttal. So it's very short how much people can actually stay in a conversation when the tension is mounting. And what you want is to turn it around so that people don't feel attacked. They can pay attention. They can turn it from conflict to empathy, if you want. And then validate it and still say, you know, I don't think I've done this, but I can see that that's how you would experience it. That's how you would see it. That's how you feel it. That kind of thing. And that fundamental shift from a negative escalation to a reflective listening, from reacting to reflecting, is really where you turn the whole thing around.
So you're currently listening to Esther Perel, a relationships expert, talking about how to do marriage, which is the topic of my KX935's The Share in Our Tonight. Perel feels that fighting in a marriage is almost de rigueur. And what you've been hearing is from a panel discussion in which Perel is the only woman amongst men. And the host of the panel turns to Perel and asks if she feels that there's any difference between the way men engage in a marital fight and the way women do.
There's a lot of studies that have checked on the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system in men in situations of stress. And if we are in an intense conversation and fight, often the men will look up, the men will move their bodies, they will try to regulate themselves, to lower their physiological reaction by trying to create some space from the heat. Whereas women can stay in there much longer without necessarily dysregulating to the same extent. Besides that, I actually think that what I just described, I can see between two men, between two women, between a man and a woman. I see it in families. I think it is more A, temperament, and we are born with a temperament. B, what was reinforced in our growing up. C, what the culture tells us. It is definitely a man who's angry is a man who's in charge. A woman who's angry is hysterical. Let's be very clear. The cultural valence on assertiveness or aggression is not the same for men and women all over the world. So there is layers of different things, but I don't think these things are intrinsic to gender.
What is a good way to end the fight?
There's different things. One, you know what? I don't think at this moment I'm doing justice to this conversation. I'm going to go cool off and we'll come back. And then you need to not follow me around the house. You need to let me go and trust that I will come back. The person who leaves has the right to go, but they have to be the one to come back. Two, you know what? Apology is really important. When I did this yesterday, I was out of line. I was angry. I wanted to hurt. I felt attacked. And I really regret this. And I'm really sorry. That goes a long way too. Three, letter writing. I've done a lot of letter writing with people because when you're alone and when you sit with yourself and you write to someone and when I receive it and I read it, you hear people completely differently. So sometimes it's go and just say, when I fought yesterday, it brought back something for me that has nothing to do with you actually. It brought back the time when I felt that I was always being kicked by my brother and that I had no place in this house and you just made me feel small like that. And I got in touch with that. And when that beast hits me, I am ready to kill. And I just wanted you to know that. That's variations of letter writing with accountability. What is accountability? It's your ability to take responsibility for what you did without being mired by shame. Responsibility is a relational conscience, so is guilt. Shame is I feel so bad that I want to go hide and I don't want to talk about it, and so the next day we pretend like nothing happened. But it sits there. You know, I just don't want you to remind me. You know how bad I feel about myself, not about what I did to you. And that's the thing in a fight, is that people often feel terrible about themselves afterwards. They don't like it. They don't like what comes out of them. They don't like how they behave. They don't like the face that they can have, even if it's a quiet face, you know, a seeding face. 3 days I walk around like this, you know, and make you plead with me. But all kinds of dances like that. And when you can just say, I don't like this about me, why is that so crucial? Because what is the fundamental definition of self-esteem? Is your ability to see yourself as a flawed person and still hold yourself in high regard. I mean, my parents were both concentration camp survivors of the German Nazi camps. They both are the sole survivors of their entire family. They both were about 5 years in the war and then another 5 years illegal refugees in Belgium. They met on the road the day of liberation as they came out of their own respective camps that were close by. And from very young, I would ask questions. Why don't I have grandparents? Where is everybody? Why do we have such a small family? How come you have an accent? And then as you grow and they tell you the story, then you say, what made you want to stay alive? What makes somebody want to stay alive 5 years as you live face to face with death? You know, what did you do when other people gave up? What is the difference between not being dead and being alive? Which is really the foundational question that I work on with couples. It's not just to be surviving, but what does it take to be thriving? And so I think a certain interest in the human condition, in the limits of what we can tolerate, in what it means to fall in love in the concentration camp for my dad. Like, how could you still, in the midst of this, humanize yourself and experience feelings that normally you're not meant to feel when you're treated like animals? And I just became really fascinated by what gives us meaning. My father adored my mother and felt like he had found the woman that he would never have married if there wasn't a war, because they would never have met. And my mother definitely was a much more explosive, reactive person. And he had a way of just kind of disappearing. And then she would definitely amplify and he would minimize and she would rise more. And then he had a way of just going and giving her a kiss and saying, is this worth it? After all you've gone through, is this worth it? And just I had an amazing way to pacify her or to shut her up, whichever way you want to look at it. But it was effective. He just kind of would say, keep it in perspective. After all this, we're going to fight over that. It makes every problem feel rather insignificant.
For sure. So that's about it for my sharing out tonight on the topic of how to do marriage. If you want to hear this show again, it podcasts on iTunes or go to our dedicated website, kx935.com/shows/the-sharon-hour. That's sharing without the G, a pun on my name, hour with the H. That's just for my show. We have lots of other shows. We do lots of other things. Please check out our website, kx935.com, for all our various upcoming events. And do come back and listen to the Sharon Hour again every Monday night at 9. Meanwhile, this is Sharon James wishing you a great week ahead.